Welcome back to the Dog Gone Wrong podcast, where myself and others share their mistakes and help you lift the guilt burden. I'm your host, Sarah Roper, the multi-dog maven.
Hello, pod crew. This week I have Bethany Bell with me. We have only just met, like literally virtually, to record this. So I'm really interested to see what, you know, what Beth's gonna tell us. So she's a qualified behaviorist, a CDD practitioner, author. Love to speak to fellow authors, all good. Ethical dog expert, founder of the Canine Ethical Associates and the creator of Canine Dialogue Dynamics, which is the CDD. Holistic, compassionate approach to teaching dogs through conversation rather than commands, conditioning or treat-based methods. Her work focuses on fostering deep and meaningful connections between dogs and their humans, ensuring emotional well-being, resilience and trust. So welcome, Beth. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. I hope you are too.
Yeah, I'm good. So would you like to start by just telling us, you know, who you share your life with, you know, what dogs and things like that?
Well, I share my life with two Spaniels, and they were both rescue Spaniels. They are really, they've been my teachers throughout the years. But when I first got my first Spaniel, Steve, I was just really a budding new fresh trainer. I was practicing all the 4-3 training. I wasn't quite running my own business just at that time, but I had been training as an assistant for quite a few years. And as you're kind of emerging into the industry, I thought, yeah, I know, I get this. I can handle all of this. And you're very, very confident. And then Steve came along and taught me that I didn't actually know that much at all. And I'd made many, many mistakes in the early start, you know, probably for the first year, I made the most mistakes with him. But he taught me so much. And really, I hold him accountable to where I'm at today, because he really did teach me that there were certain things that couldn't just be trained away, and that you needed to understand emotions and individuality between dogs. Then my next dog came along, and that was Dave, my next Spaniel. He was also a rescue, and he's just my really like feisty kind of dog that's like full of character, and really taught me that, you know, when a dog doesn't want to do something, they don't have to do something. And he just like give you that stare like, yeah, but why? So I hold him more accountable for kind of teaching me to question things and ask the question why. So that was really a learning curve, and I've had a couple of fosters along the way as well, but currently at the moment I'm with both my dogs, Steve and Dave, who are turning 10 this year.
Bless. They're getting older now. I love the names. Yeah. Absolutely love the names, but I'm sure you've heard that before, but it is I'm sure the pod listeners will have kind of grasped the fact that it's such a common story of, you know, we end up with this dog that kind of launches us into the industry, and we learn so much from them because they're not the easiest. But you've also touched on something that we've discussed as well before, which is the Dunning-Kruger effect, as in you get in, you kind of learn a bit, you think you know everything, that, you know, you can rule the world because you know everything to do with dogs, and then an experience or a dog comes along and you come crashing down to the ground, you know, your pride takes a massive hit, and then you go, okay, maybe I don't know as much as what I thought I did, and then it's a gradual kind of incline back up. Yeah. Okay, so what would you say are your biggest mistakes or learning points along your journey with dogs?
Well, there's quite a few. I mean, I think I've been making mistakes personally with my own dogs. As a first time dog parent, I was making lots of mistakes to start with. And I think with my own dogs, one of the biggest mistakes that I was making was trying to get them to achieve things that I wanted them to achieve for me, and feeling like a total failure when I couldn't get my dog to do something or achieve something that was in the kind of training. You're kind of learning all about training, and everything's like in that training framework. And if I couldn't get my dogs to do something, I felt like a complete failure. When I couldn't train problems away, I felt like a failure. So one of the biggest mistake I felt was not really seeing the dog that was in front of me, and I was seeing the dog I was told that I should be seeing. So my dog wasn't doing and meeting all the kind of checklists and going, my dog can't do that, and my dog can't do this, and I should be able to train my dogs to be, you know, like the cafe dogs that I was used to growing up, because both my dogs, the family dogs that we had, were cafe dogs. You could take them anywhere, they just adapted to everything and they were fine. And I had that expectation in in my head when I was getting two rescue dogs, which was a completely different story. So really, it wasn't just about kind of fuck around and find out, which was what I did. That was probably the biggest mistake.
I love that. Sorry, I've got to interrupt you there. Fuck around and find out. That's the hashtag of the day for me. I'm stealing that one. Sorry, carry on.
So yeah, it was like I would kind of like take my dogs to the cafe and, you know, a big deal would happen, something would happen. Like one of the biggest, most embarrassing moments of my life with my dogs was taking Dave to a cafe and doing some of the training with him. And we didn't really know him that well at the time. We'd only rescued him, I think, 2 months prior to this. And we took him to the cafe. I was doing some training and settles while we were eating our food. And the waitress came along, brought down a sandwich, and Dave just dived up, took the sandwich, knocked everything over. He was also tied to a plastic chair that my husband was sitting on. He zoomed off with the sandwich he'd just stolen. The chair leg flew off. My husband came crashing down, and everyone was not laughing except for me, although I was highly, highly embarrassed.
Inwardly dying as well.
I was inwardly dying. And, you know, and you're just like, yeah, you know, this is not the best trainer moment that I've had in front of all, you know, my whole family, everyone, when I'm like preaching, I'm a dog trainer now. I know what I'm doing. And then that moment happened where it was like, clearly I don't know what I'm doing. And clearly this was all a mistake that I could have avoided. But yeah, that was me just taking them out. Well, let's see what happens, see what he's like in a cafe. And I found out.
Sorry, I really shouldn't laugh, but you couldn't write that. Like, you really couldn't. And we're better off laughing about it, aren't we? I mean, I know I'm sure at the time, you know, you were like, hello, floor, please swallow me up now.
Yes. It was. And so that was definitely one of my more funny moments with my own dogs. But in terms of like mistakes, I mean, we learn from those mistakes. So I learned from that. You know, I learned that, you know, don't just assume, you know, a dog, you know, don't just assume and put them in a situation, throw them in at the deep end and expect them to work it out and be fine. He needed a lot more guidance than that. We needed to work out who he was and where his struggles were. You know, that was avoidable. It was and all the mistakes that I look at that I've made have all been avoidable, but I wouldn't have learned from those mistakes. I wouldn't have become the person I am today if I hadn't have made those mistakes. So it's like you look back on in hindsight, and hindsight is always a bit of a kick, but you look back in hindsight and you go, yeah, I could have done this differently, I could have done that differently, but if that hadn't have happened, then maybe I would have done that differently with a different dog, and you know, it could have been a lot worse, who knows. But you know, there's been mistakes that I've made professionally as well as personally in my own life too, and had to learn from those.
Yeah, definitely. I think it always comes back to, for me, of you don't know what you don't know until you know, and until you've made those mistakes, because like you say, until you've made them, you don't realize what the potential consequences may be, so you know how to avoid it in future. I mean, some of this podcast for me is to help others avoid this. You know, they can hear that even the professionals get it wrong and that we've, you know, made these mistakes, and help others try and avoid that by these stories, whether they're funny or awful or whatever. But we all will make mistakes no matter what. It's just about kind of reducing them and making sure that when mistakes do happen, that we do learn from them rather than just keep repeating them.
Yeah.
So that was with Dave. What, you know, tell us a bit more about his background, if you know it, kind of rough age when you got him, and, you know, tell us a bit more about his story.
Oh, so Dave came to me when he was about 11 months old. We were probably his third or fourth home. So he'd had quite a lot going on in his, short life at that time. He came to us quite overweight, with lots of issues surrounding food. And from what I could find out, we got him directly from the owner at that time. And what I could find out at that time was that she'd rescued him and he was, you know, skin and bones. And so there'd been some kind of neglect in that situation. And then they overfed him to compensate for that. So then and obviously his metabolism was all messed up. So when he came to us, his food issues were really, really severe. Surprisingly, there was no like food aggression or anything like that, which I would have expected from that kind of situation. But he didn't have that, any kind of guarding issues. What it was the stealing. and he couldn't help himself. So he would inhale food. He would, you know, go snuffling out looking for food all the time, was never satisfied with the amount that he'd eaten. So we had to like work out the right amounts for him, because he would never say, right, I've had enough, I'm full now. So we had to really work that out, and also get the nutrition right, and, you know, making sure that everything worked for him. So we got him on, you know, real food. And as you said at the start, you know, at first I was like, this is the greatest kibble. This is going to work. We then went on to raw for a while. And then as he aged, we got him on to home cooked fresh food. So we've kind of been through both. But it's something we had to work through, is working out this, how to manage that, you know, the stealing and the going through, because of safety, because he was going to eat something that wasn't, you know, safe for him to eat, and raid the bins and take food off your plates. And, you know, it was literally to the point where he would jump up onto the table, and he would, like, if you didn't have him restrained, he would be on the table with you eating your food. And so, you know, we had to work out a lot about Dave. But he's a really happy-go-lucky dog. Everything's like positive for him. So he is something, he is a personality that just sees everything as a positive, as an opportunity. You know, he is in a nice way mischievous. You know, I don't class dogs as good or bad or anything like that, but mischievous for me just ties up his personality in that nice way. So for him, that's his personality, really. But Steve is like the total opposite. So Steve is a dog that looks like an athlete, and even at the age of 10 will behave like an athlete. You know, you're like waiting and you're thinking they'll slow down soon. That didn't happen. So 10, he's still flying over logs when he's going for his run in the woods, and, you know, still, you know, he's got his fitness levels that have never reduced as he's aged. But his mind is all over the place. You know, he came to us at 7 months. He had OCD. He was shadow chasing, light reflection chasing. He could not cope with other dogs. Training wasn't something that he could handle, because he was so OCD. Everything had to be like a ritual for him. So he was a real learning curve for us, because, you know, he also had separation anxiety, which we'd never dealt with before. And that was a huge, huge learning curve. So, but he's, you know, a lot calmer now, a lot more confident now. But you can see where he's had some kind of, something's happened to him in the past where he has, that's always remained. But also, you know, we don't know his breeding, you know, what happened in, you know, when you're taking on a rescue dog, you don't know the history of the breeding. So, you know, there could be something that happened during the breeding process, and, you know, genetics play a massive part in that too. So he's been the most complex personality, I would have said, that we have out of the two, but definitely a huge learning curve for us.
And you say they're both spangles. What variety of spangles?
So Steve is, we think, and we were told that he was crossed, a Springer Spaniel crossed with a Golden Retriever. I don't see an awful lot of Retriever in him, but, you know, he definitely isn't quite a full Spaniel. So he's, you know, very, very energetic, very much, we would predict, like, he came from working Spaniel stock, or at least working Retriever, because he's got all the working traits, and he's also, you know, physically and mentally. And Dave, we just think he's a Cocker, just a show Cocker, but I wouldn't have said that he's got show, you know, good show stock in him, if you like, because he's got, you know, he's got like the strange posture, and, you know, where you think, okay, this might have been more backyard breeding going on here, something not quite right. But yeah, he's definitely a Cocker Spaniel, but not a good breeding stock, if you like.
No, yeah, yeah, but like there's show type and there's working type, and he's more show type than working type. Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. And just for my own interest, would you be looking at getting another Spangle type in the future, or would you be looking at getting something different?
We've been discussing this actually recently. I mean, I think I don't know if I would. I think that Spaniels were right for us at that time. But when we first got them, we were in our early 20s and we had a lot more energy. Now I've hit my early 30s, I'm like, I don't have as much energy now to kind of keep up with the, you know, especially when they were younger, we had to walk them 2-3 hours a day, you know, just to, that was what they needed. So I'm not sure that I would get another Spaniel. I don't know if it's right for us. I think we would probably rescue again. and just see what finds us, you know, who needs us at that time. But I do think we're leaning more towards like a corgi type. I think we have fallen in love with the corgi breed. And, you know, we were, for a time we were like, it was like Newfoundland or corgis. So two extremely
not much difference.
So I think we finally kind of settled with corgi, but if we could find one that needed a home, then that would be the perfect situation for us, really.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I usually ask these questions if we get to it with guests, but I get what you're saying about early 20s, more energy. I mean, I'm now late 30s and the Daxies are great because they will go. I've got 3-inch long-haired Daxies and they will go as long as I want them to go or not go at all. And they're happy with both. And that is great. But over the time I've usually had big dogs as well as Daxies, a mixture. And I've had Springers alongside the Daxies. And I've also had, I've had a big mixture, short term, but I'd say for the longest period I had 4 Daxies, 2 Springers kind of ish, as in I had one most of the time and an additional one for some of that time, and in that mix was also a flat coat retriever, and I had a lot more energy then. And then I've had a few years of just having Daxies, and now I've got a more or less show type, bit of working type in there, but more or less show type lab, and she's only young, she's under 18 months, and I'm enjoying the bonuses of having a big dog again. I am a big dog person, as much as everyone knows me for Daxies. But it's quite nice to not have the working line be too strong within her, because she will go, you know, and we introduced her to bike riding at the weekend and stuff like that. But she's quite happy with a mooch, as much as she is if you took her on a 3-hour hike. And that suits me perfectly. When there was a while where I was considering a working type Goldie, I know I have not got the energy for that, nor the time. And the other half wants a cattle dog. And he has no idea. And he's older than me. And I was like, cattle dog would be a little bit of a challenge. I don't think it's going to happen, if I'm really honest. But it's interesting, you know, like, because I work with, you know, I'm sure you found this as well, when you work with clients, that they've always had the same breed, for example. And it's usually a large breed, and they've had dog after dog over the years. And then they've got to, say, late 50s, 60s, 70s even, and got a new one, and then suddenly they're struggling. And a lot of that is down to they've not really counted for the fact that they've got older since the last one was a puppy and not quite got the same strength or energy levels. And if I'm already feeling this in my late 30s and you're feeling that in your early 30s,
yeah,
God help them.
Yeah, it's something as well that I mean, again, another learning curve was, you know, I've had different breeds over the years, and I had foster dog and working, and, you know, all these different types of breeds. And I think you learn a lot about yourself as well, because, you know, you have to pair your personality traits with the general breed traits of the breed you're looking at. And we've gone through, you know, a whole list of, oh, you know, I love that breed. And, you know, like, we love Spaniels, you know, they're a heart dog for us. Absolutely love them. But the lifestyle that we're going to be leading going from our mid-30s onto our 40s, it's not going to be easy with, you know, a young Spaniel, and that wouldn't be fair to put that on them. So I think I think a lot of mistakes and rehoming and things like that happen, not all the time and not always, but it's not like the sole responsibility. But I think a lot of it is where people don't understand the matching of your personality, your lifestyle, to match with the breed trait that you're, you know, the breed that you're looking for. And, you know, does that work, you know, aside from them just being a great breed and they look great and they have these amazing traits and they're funny and they're brilliant, but also, do they actually suit your current lifestyle and the lifestyle that you'll be leading into as you get older? And I think that that's something we should all ask ourselves, because it's a really hard thing when your personality and lifestyle do not match your breed's traits, because lots of problems can happen from there, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally with you on that one. You either change your lifestyle to suit, or the dog ends up going massively self-employed and becomes a real issue. And it's which are you prepared to do? Definitely, you know, the middle book that I wrote was all about, you know, choosing the right breed and the right, you know, puppy within the litter, the right breeder, but like, get the right dog that suits you. And it shouldn't, as much as we all have aesthetic preferences, which, you know, I don't think we can discount totally,
Right.
I have a weird thing because I'm a little bit OCD that although I ended up with Springers for a while, they weren't particularly my choice. And I loved them. I'm not saying it, but I wouldn't have gone out and bought them, mainly because they're not symmetrical, because I'm a weirdo. But give me a black and tan any day because they're symmetrical, you know, of other breeds, whether it's a Rottweiler, whether it's a Dachshund, whatever. But that's just me. But I think a lot of people do choose dogs more on the aesthetic, as in, I think that dog's really cute and I find that dog very attractive and I want that dog. And there is still this, and, you know, I grew up with it that a dog is a dog is a dog, you know, no matter what breed, all dogs are the same, as in, you make them into what you want them to be and to be a family dog, and they'll all just kind of fit into your box when that isn't the case. And I think part of that probably came from, I'm sure you'll be the same, that in the years growing up, there was more mongrels and crossbreeds than there was pedigrees. You'd see Labradors, you'd see Jack Russells, which are now classed as a pedigree, but then weren't. You know, you'd see breed types, but there wouldn't be lots of, like every other dog wouldn't be a pedigree breed. There'd be mainly like mongrels and crossbreeds. So in some ways, yes, they're more likely to fit into a box of sorts. But when you've got all these pedigree breeds with all the different breed instincts and the purposes that they've been bred for, they're not going to. And I think it's still a case of, you know, us professionals trying to educate the general public that just because you get a dog that you think looks nice does not mean that it's going to fit into your life in the way that you want it to.
I totally agree. I mean, I think I'd say I don't think there's anything wrong with liking the way a dog looks or having a preference to how a dog looks. I really don't think that's a problem at all. I think that that's normal and natural. But I think it's just basing it around other factors alongside that and not making that the sole factor that you're looking for to make that decision with.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Do I keep seeing one of them behind you moving?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's Steve over here. So he's your black and tan.
Good. We're all good. Oh, bless.
But yeah, and Dave is currently under my feet. So you can't really see him, but he's having a snooze. But yeah, they're just chilling at the moment because we've just had our run in the morning. So they're just, I mean, at the moment, they've calmed down to a state where we can have our hour run and then I might have a half an hour extra walk later. And they will be content with that. But yeah, that was not the case probably for the first 6-7 years of their lives, really.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a commitment. They are.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. Especially with Spangles, I've found that, you know, like a big misconception with pet dog owners and things is we need to walk the legs off them and we need to walk them for 3-4 hours a day, which some dogs, you know, I'm not saying they don't need, but it's like you end up getting into this cycle of you are creating an athlete and then making it that stamina get better and better and to the point where you can't keep up. And there are, as I'm sure you've learned along the way, but I know you will have, there are other things to do with them other than run their legs off, because otherwise you're not going to win that battle.
Absolutely, yeah. And some dogs don't benefit from that, you know. Some dogs do, and I think, you know, it's always avoiding like blanket term and everything. So it's, you know, looking at the individual. So, you know, Steve is a dog that gets frustrated if he skips a walk. He really likes to have that. Dave is a dog that's like, you know what, it's a bit cold, it's a bit wet, I'm in my bed, I don't really want to move. So, you know, he's the dog that, you know, doesn't need a walk every single day, and, you know, he will choose, and I'll give them that choice. Are you coming with us today or are you staying behind? So, you know, that's something. It's not a right. Every dog needs to walk an hour. Every dog needs to walk 3 hours. This type of breed only ever can walk, you know, for this amount of time. It's just look at the temperament of them. You know, are they physically able to, and do they feel like it? You know, giving them that choice to see if they want to do that or not. And if they are stressed, maybe they want to, you know, have 3 days off of walking. And sometimes some dogs do find that helpful, but not every breed, not every dog. Some dogs are like really pent up if they have 3 days off after a stressful event. So it's looking at the individual and seeing what works for them, really.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's move on to other mess ups or mistakes or learning points that you've had along the way then.
Yeah, I mean, I think my My biggest learning point was a mistake that was really quite dangerous. I did actually mess up big time with a client, and it was a real schoolboy error mistake that could have ended up a lot worse. And it happened where I was, first of all, overrun. I had too many clients, so my brain was not where it should have been. I was I couldn't say no. So I didn't learn at that time in my business to say no, I'm too full, I can't answer. I was saying yes to everything and everyone because I felt that if I didn't, I was either letting people down or I wasn't coming across as professional. And when you're running a business and it's really new to you, those things are really important and you overthink everything. So you're like, I got to say yes to everything. So I had too many clients, I'd seen too many people in that day. And when I got to this client, it was a ridgeback with aggression issues, with people coming in the house. Obviously, he was doing what he's bred to do. And I hadn't done the background check properly. I had said in email, and I have like all the things in email before we go into someone's house. I'd said, you know, make sure your dog is muzzled. If they have, you know, if they're guarding, if they're aggressive to other people, we need to make sure they're muzzled. And I hadn't double checked on that day. Normally, I just send like a little reminder or a text message or like 10 minutes before I arrived. Now, I was late because I had just come from a client, it had overrun. The scope that I was seeing people in the area that I was in was quite large. So I had driven 1.5 hours from one client to this one. So I was already late. I was already stressed and I didn't double check. So when I rang the doorbell, the guy just opened the door, let his ridgeback out, and the ridgeback was like right at me, you know, really going for me. And everything I'd learned to do and trained and done, it just went woof, out of my head. I was, you know, really panicking. I was frozen. I'd gone into freeze, and the dog floored me, and, you know, it did bite me. It was the winter. I was wearing a really thick coat. So, you know, thankfully I didn't actually get penetrated or bitten properly, but I was left bruised afterwards. And all of that was completely preventable. It was entirely my fault. I do think that, you know, because my responsibility was to avoid those things from happening, to stop and don't put myself in danger, but also the dog or anyone else in danger. And that was a real learning curve for me, is to, you know, make sure that you have time to do those safety checks and to prevent these things from happening. It was a moment I was definitely not proud of. I was deeply, deeply ashamed. And luckily, really luckily, nothing came of that, you know, and when I managed to work with that dog and it was all fine, that could have ended up a lot worse. And I was putting myself in a really, really dangerous situation, and I was doing a disservice to that dog and the dog's owner, because I was putting their dog in a situation they weren't ready for. I needed to make sure that, you know, the owner was also not stressed and had time to put the muzzle on and there was space, and I was managing, you know, to make sure the dog didn't feel that I was just walking into, you know, his safe area. So it wasn't the dog's fault. That was a human error, but totally avoidable and could have ended up a lot worse. And so I learned, firstly, I cannot work efficiently taking on this many clients a day, because by the time he was my last client of the day, I was shot. You know, my brain had melted. I was no good. And I set that up in a really, really bad way. So I learned to schedule my clients better, to take on staff when I needed more staff. So take on and get extra help, and learn that business management side of things. That was totally new to me, but always safety first. That was priority then, you know, making sure that I can really get the point across to owners. Like, if I'm coming in, have you got your dog muzzled, and check that 5 minutes before I get there so that it's not been forgotten. So that was my more serious learning curve, I think, as a professional. And, you know, acted like a complete, that was a total unprofessional thing to do. And I have learned since that is, you know, you have to take those things seriously and don't just squeeze as many clients in a day that it is too much for you. Even if you feel pressured, you have to say no and understand when the right time to say no is.
For your own safety, as much as the dogs and the clients, I get that. But I've also been there, if the, not that particular situation, but the whole spreading yourself too thin and not being able to give the best service to the clients. You've got the clients, you're busy, but you're too busy to be able to deliver as you want to, if that makes sense. Yeah, and that's a big lesson. And I think that's a really, really good point to make on here. So thank you. And thank you for sharing. because it is a big thing that we do in this industry. We do feel that pressure and we want to help. Of course we do that. That's why we're here. You know, we love the dogs. We love to make improvements, to improve the quality of life of dogs and their owners or caregivers, you know, however you want to frame it. And, you know, we feel like, well, you know, they want help and I can help. So let's do it. But it's finding that balance, I think, as well, because I mean, the mental strain, like you said, you know, your head was gone. It's quite a lot. Although I suppose to some outsiders, it might just, well, you just go around a couple of houses, you talk to them, you do a bit of dog training, and then you go on to the next one. How hard is that? Well, what a lot of them, until you're in this job, you don't realise that you actually end up becoming a counsellor in a lot of situations, partially a marriage counsellor half the time as well as kind of, I'm trying to think of the right words now, an interpreter for the dog, of explaining how the dog is feeling and why the dog is feeling that way and how to help them. And yeah, it's a lot. It does take a lot. I think I learned that lesson, well, many, many years ago, as I'm sure you did, but it's the being able to give ourselves enough space as much as our clients to be able to recharge mentally, emotionally, to meet the next client.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, you know, there is a lot of emotions that go into the work that we do, you know, particularly even if it's just going and doing, you know, people think it's just going and doing some training. And, you know, even if you're not doing behavior work, you are in a sense when you're a trainer, because you're looking at the emotions of the dog, you're looking at the emotions of this family or this individual person, and you take that on and you're trying to be professional and empathetic. And we generally are very empathetic, you know, in this industry. We are, because we want to go and we want to improve not just the dog's lives, but the people involved in that. And so we do take on a lot, and it is, you do get mental burnout, because if you're taking on too much, you're absorbing everyone else's problems that they're going through, and you're taking that on and trying to be the counsellor and in every situation when it comes to the dogs, which is a great thing to do. But you do need to make sure that you have some time out and some, you know, TLC for yourself, to make sure that you're capable then to take on for the next lot of people, because we're not indestructible. We're people, you know, we have emotions as well. And we need to make sure that we are doing the right things for our own mental health when we're going through these situations.
Yeah. What are your downtime activities? What are your things that you do to recharge when you've been mentally drained from this job?
I do digital art. So I really like it. It's like just a hobby. I don't need to achieve anything with it. So I really like to just draw and paint. I use a program on my iPad called Procreate. And I'm, you know, because I'm useless when it comes to like pen and paper. I've never been an artistic person at all. Like, art was never something I could do. I couldn't draw. And then I just got into digital art, and all of a sudden I could do, it just worked. It just clicked with me. So that's something, like, one of the things that I always say to people is, I think everyone has a creative side. I think everyone has something that they can create and do. And you don't need to do it to achieve something. You do it because it's just something that helps you unwind. For some people, it's arts and crafts and like physical, you know, doing something physically, like whether it's knitting or crocheting or painting and drawing. Sometimes it's digital stuff. Sometimes it's like photography. So I do that side of things for me, because it's something that I can get creative, and that's an outlet for me, especially like I don't need to try to turn this into a business. I don't need to try and make money from it. I don't need to try and do anything. It's just for me. It's just to do because I enjoy it. So for me, that is something I like to do. But also just, you know, going for country walks, and you know, I do a bit of photography. Again, for me, it's not for trying to achieve anything or trying to get a website built with all this stuff. It was literally just something that I enjoy for the sake of enjoying it, rather than having to achieve something with it. So I think being creative certainly has helped me to just unwind and just not try to learn about too many things at once, just to allow my brain to just switch off and do, you know, be creative.
Thank you. Yeah, I love the fact that you've got something, and I think we all need something that kind of that thing that we can just switch off and do and recharge. For me, it's horse riding or carriage driving, spending time with my pony, essentially, which half the time I end up resisting, like, no, I haven't got time, I've, you know, blah, blah, blah. And as soon as I get on him or as soon as we're out, I'm like, why didn't I do this before? Because it's just bliss. But yeah, everyone needs something. And I think you've made a really good point there as well, of that there's no pressure, there's no target, there's no, you know, you're not doing it for money, you're not doing it to achieve something. It is literally just for the joy of it. And that's a big point. It really is. I mean, loads of people have said to me over the years, oh, you know, why don't you go into working with horses? And, you know, you've obviously got a great thing with your pony. And it's like, well, part of it is, well, I have one pony, he's my first, and, you know, that definitely does not make me an expert. But two, the whole point that I got Billy was as an escape from the dog world, and that is what he is. So I don't need to make that any more than what it is. And he is my downtime, totally. This is slightly going off topic, but I think good things to go on. I know when I'm heading for burnout, I get quite short-tempered. Not with the dogs, but, like, just snappy, like, say, with the other half, or if my phone rings, I look at it and I go, oh, for God's sake, you know, like, I'm short fused. Or the most minor things will trigger me, you know, like, I'm always clumsy, and if I bump into something, I'm then, like, annoyed at myself, like, for God's sake, Sarah, why did you do that? And they're, like, the things that I'm like, okay, I take a mental note of that, of, okay, I need to kind of rein it in a bit and take some downtime, because this is not me being the best I can be and I'm starting to burn out. What are your things that you notice when you're starting to frazzle out, or at least your brain's full and things, you know, are there things that you've found that you kind of go, okay, these are the signs, I need to do something else?
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah. So, like you, temper is definitely something. I get very irritable with software, with computer stuff. And, you know, and I just can't, I stop being able to cope. But then the other thing I do is I get into, like, a sense of overwhelm, and I end up being, I feel totally incapable of doing the most simple thing. So, like, I need to reply to this email. It's really important, but it would be a 2-minute job. Or I need, someone sent me this message and it, you know, I really want to reply to it. And it's maybe even like a 10-second job. And I can't do it because my brain is just so full. And then I think, well, if I do that, I think what it is connecting. If I answer this person, then I need to go. Then it means that I need to then go and answer that person. Then it means I have to go and do this next thing. Then it means I have to go and correct this, you know, in the course, or I need to go and do so, you know. And so you string all these things together. So this small thing in my head means that I'm going to be doing all these other things. Whereas if I actually could just apply myself, I know that. No, I can just reply to this person. It's not a big deal. So I find that I get, like, I totally switch off to everything, and then I can't, and then the longer that goes on for, if it's someone's written a comment on Facebook and it's like a lovely comment, I'm like, I'll reply to that. And then I just go, okay, well, I'll do it in a second when I'm feeling like I can go on Facebook. And then I'm like, 3 days have gone past, I can't go on Facebook. And then I'm like, now it's been 3 days, now I can't go and reply to it. So I feel that. Yeah. It becomes a thing. So that, for me, when I'm burnt out, when I know I need to go and do something else and just come back to it in a day or two, or maybe even a few days, you know, if it's a project I'm going, you know, trying to work on, sometimes I just need to stop the project, go back to it in a week when I'm feeling more refreshed. But those are the signals for me that if I can't reply to someone, or I can't send the email, or I can't do the thing I really need to do that would take me 2 minutes to do. That's what my brain is just not operating at that point.
Yeah, like, I might as well have spoke those words from my brain too. So yeah, I get in exactly the same boat. Tip for you and for the listeners is I'm all for audiobooks because, you know, if I'm on the road and things like that. So on Audible, although you could buy the book, it's a book called How to Be a Productivity Ninja. Have you come across that one?
No, I've not heard of that one, but that sounds great.
It is. And it basically, there's lots to it, but it kind of sections things out into, like, almost like small, medium and large tasks, but basically essentially what kind of brain power you're going to need for them. So I've, you know, for years I've been the right, I need to write up that email report for this behavior client, for example, which we'll put off. None of us want to do because it's brain. Like, it takes brain power. You're going to have to sit. You're going to have to focus. You can't multitask while doing it. It's like you have to really think about it. Usually, by the time you actually get round to doing it, you've put off, you know, doing it for days, and it's got to the point where it's like, I can't really get away with not doing it any longer now. So we're going to sit down and do it. And it takes you 10 minutes. And you're like, why didn't I just do that 3 days ago? It took me 10 minutes. But it's that thought of, it's 10 minutes of brain power, which I can't afford. And in that book, it kind of basically helps you plan out your days as to where your brain power sits for, and then categorizing tasks for, you know, like some things you could go, right, those 10 things, like reply to a comment on Facebook, send off a quick email to ask if something's got in stock or whatever. They're all quick things that are going to take less than 5 minutes. So you could like ream off 10 of them and not even feel like you've done any work because they're not thinking tasks. Yeah. But yeah, just, and I think the listeners would find that helpful as well. I must have listened to it 3 times over probably a decade. And it's time I went back to it because I still get into bad habits. I still kind of get back into it, especially what like we're talking about when we get into that burnout mode and then it's like, oh yeah, right, let's get back to it. Let's reset and things are all better for a while. But it's just hard to maintain the habits. But at least if you've got the tools, you know what to do, it does make life easier.
So I love that. I'm definitely going to put that to practice.
Good. Let me know how you get on with it. Because, to be fair, I've got a lot of time on the road at the minute. So I might actually put it. It's about, if I remember right, it's about 10 hours. But it's great. But as I say, there is the actual book if you're a book person. But,
I am a book person, so I'll probably get the book. Yeah, I think that's brilliant.
Good. Okay, so I think we're going to wrap it up. But would you like to tell the listeners kind of where you're based, what you're offering, and how they can get in touch and all of that kind of stuff, please?
Yeah, no problem. So I'm actually based in Surrey at the moment. So I work face to face with people around Surrey and Hampshire. I'm in the kind of Guildford side of Surrey. But a lot of my work is actually on virtual. So I work virtually. I do online courses. I've written some books as well. And what I specialise in is more of a holistic way of teaching, which is called the CDD method. That's all about using dialogue and kind of just taking a step away from training and recognising that we can't train all behavior away, and instead we need to recognize what the behavior is, where it's coming from, what the emotions are involved in that, and really apply it where we're teaching a dog through language that they can understand, and not actually through a transactional approach. So you can use it alongside ethical force-free training, which is absolutely fine. Some people like to do that, some people like to use it as its own thing, but what it really involves is really doing things naturally and respecting the dog as a dog, and working the dog in front of us and not really putting expectations on that, you know, our dog has to sit, our dog has to lie down, our dog has to do X, Y, and Z. We actually teach dogs to do things that have a purpose, and have a purpose for the dog, not just for us as well. So if you are interested in doing stuff that's more natural and holistic, and but also want to keep the ethics as well, that's definitely something that I think you'll enjoy and benefit from, and so will your dog. But it's more about, I generally have a lot of courses. I've got courses for reactivity, a book for reactivity, and writing more books as well, for applying it to puppies and teenagers and adults and rescue dogs. But that's kind of where I've come in from at the moment, where we're at. But yeah, it's more of building a community at this stage, of people that are like-minded and, you know, really want to do things differently. And if training hasn't worked for your dog, then maybe this is something you could look into applying as well.
And what's your website? Where do everyone kind of find you?
At the moment, I've got the website called The CDD Method, and I've also got a Facebook group. So I've got a Facebook group called Redefining Reactivity. That's a free group where you can go if you're wanting to learn about this approach and reactivity. I've got the group called The CDD Method, and that is just for people that don't necessarily have any behaviour issues they want to tackle, but they just want to apply it to their dog's lives. So there's that. I'm on Facebook. I've just joined TikTok as well, which I think I'm called Bethany The CDD Method, I think. And I've got Canine Ethical Associates, which is my business name. So that's my business name. And I'm kind of on all platforms, and I'm trying to kind of spread out a little bit on those different platforms, but predominantly on Facebook and my website.
Okay, cool. And you'll send me hopefully all the links so I can put them in the show notes?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Fab. Well, thank you very much for joining me. I've really enjoyed this. I love how we've kind of gone off on a tangent, which is quite common for me. But I think we've covered some really good points, and it's been really nice to get to know you more. So thank you.
Likewise. Yeah, I've had a great time. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to come in on here.
No worries. No worries. I will leave it there for the listeners, and I will be back next week. I will see you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dog Gone Wrong podcast. If you could do me a quick favour, like or follow the pod, rate and leave a review, and maybe share with a dog-owning friend. Let's get the word out there and ensure there is less guilt around the mistakes. Thank you again, and we'll be back next week.